right, if everybody could take their seats and we got no quorum yet. All right, we're going to get started. We don't have a quorum, so we won't take any official action, but Representative Kriesel, if you want to come up, you don't have to move your bill yet because we haven't got enough people here, so... We're going to start a new, not only absent, or we're going to have tardy now to it.
Sure. Yeah, if you want to, over by him.
Representative Kriesel, why don't you go ahead and just give us your opening remarks and proceed however you wish on 2706.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2706 to the committee today. This bill is about providing law enforcement with the tools they need to combat crime and returning dedicated funds to its proper place. This legislation returns $650,000 of the $1.3 million annually diverted from the auto theft account to the general fund back to the hands of our law enforcement professionals. Of that amount, $325,000 is placed in the auto theft account and $325,000 is placed in the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force account. This initiative was brought to me by a broad-based law enforcement and business coalition. Those entities supporting the legislation include Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Minnesota Sheriffs Association, Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Bankers Association. With me today to go into more detail about those resources going into the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force is the chair of the task force and chief deputy of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, John Kirkwood. After Chief Deputy Kirkwood will be Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, who will go into more detail about the auto theft program and the need for additional resources.
Thank you, Representative Kriesel.
Chief Deputy, could we just, excuse me for the interruption, but we've got a quorum now, so if we can bring it to order, then we can proceed on your bill. Mr. Sparby, you got 10? Got your check in. Go ahead.
Chairman Cornish.
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard. Representative Mullery. Representative Doubt. Representative Gauthier.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hilty. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Kelly.
Here.
Representative Kriesel.
Here.
Representative Kiefer. Here. Representative Leidiger.
Here.
Representative Mariani. Representative McDonald. Representative Moran.
Here.
Representative Nornes.
Here.
Representative Slocum. Representative Smith.
Okay. And we'll officially bring to order the Public Safety, Crime Prevention, Policy, and Finance Committee and entertain a motion to approve the minutes of March 8th. Representative Leidiger moves the minutes of March 8th, whether he knows it or not. Any additions or corrections or comments on the minutes of March 8th? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. And now, Representative Kriesel, you can move your bill, and you know that it's going to Commerce then? Okay, go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 2706 passed and be referred to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, folks, you've heard the motion, and Chief Deputy Kirkwood, go ahead with your sorry for the interruption before.
No problem, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is John Kirkwood. I'm the Chief Deputy of Ramsey County Sheriff's Office and also the Chair of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, which I was named to at the end of last year. I've been a member of the Financial Crimes Task Force Advisory Board since 2009, while in my previous position as a special agent in charge of the United States Secret Service in the Minneapolis field office, which I held for the past 7 years. In 2009, the legislature created the advisory board to replace the oversight committee over the task force. The advisory board not only provides guidance and oversight to the task force, but also keeps the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety apprised of cases, accomplishments, challenges, and some of the emerging financial crime trends within our state. With me today are some fellow members of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force Advisory Board, Mr. Pat Henry, commander of the task force, Chief Jim Eckstead of the Baxter Police Department, which sponsors an investigator to the task force, and Mr. Emery Adordio of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and also the representative from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association to the task force. Mr. Adordio also prosecutes many of our state cases that are generated by the task force. By way of history, just very briefly, as you may already know, in 2000, the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force was created by the legislature under 299A.681 to combat the growing problem of financial crimes that span multiple jurisdictions throughout Minnesota, in particular identity theft. In 2009, the task force was restructured and put under the command and control of the BCA. The task force is a collaboration of state, local, and federal law enforcement, state and federal prosecutors, all working together closely with the private sector partners in retail and banking industry, as well as the insurance industry, to combat fraud and financial crimes. With a membership including local, state, and federal law enforcement and prosecutors, the task force has a broad jurisdictional and prosecutive reach to investigate and disrupt financial crime offenders and organized criminal enterprises whose acts impact victims locally, nationally, and globally, as you can see from the map of a recent case, recent operation the task force had called Operation Starburst. Operation Starburst, as you can see, is an example of the types of complex, high fraud loss fraud cases with multiple defendants that the task force is capable of working successfully, provided they have the adequate law enforcement participation and resources. One of the other aspects, in addition to the financial crimes, a broad range of financial crimes that the task force works together, is a training aspect of local law enforcement in best practices for investigating the complex and sometimes convoluted financial crimes that come across their departments, as well as a public education aspect to help prevent fraud. That too is another key responsibility of the task force related to preventing victimization of different types of internet and various phone scams, such as advance fee scams, lottery scams, as we call them, the hello grandma and love scams that are out there on the internet, as well as black money scams. Currently, the participation of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force from the local level includes the BCA, the Baxter Police Department, Duluth Police Department, Edina and Minneapolis Police Department, Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, and until just recently, the Wright County Sheriff's Office. We also have part-time participation on a case-by-case basis from our partners at the Department of Commerce Insurance Fraud Division, who we've worked some cases together with as well. From a federal standpoint, participation includes the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, IRS Criminal Investigations, Homeland Security Investigations, the United States Secret Service, and also some part-time participation from the Social Security Office of Administration, our Office Inspector General, and Veterans Administration, the U.S. State Department. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here today to emphasize the importance of local law enforcement participation in the survival of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force and the need to establish additional dedicated and sustainable funding to help restore our operating funds to the 2007 appropriation levels. The majority of the funding for the Financial Crimes Task Force goes to reimbursement for local law enforcement departments to offset their expenses that they incur from dedicating full-time investigators to the task force. I am very fortunate to have had the experience of working a variety of financial crimes with local law enforcement in several cities throughout my 25-year career as a federal agent, and now conversely am involved in combating those same types of financial crimes as a local law enforcement official working with the feds. In those years as a federal investigator and as a supervisor, I saw daily the importance of the law enforcement relationship in identifying and investigating financial crimes. The majority of those cases that I worked were locally generated and initiated, if not almost all of them, as is true with the majority of the cases that are currently being worked by the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. This was a case in Operation Starburst, which again you have in front of you, where many of the leads were developed at the local level through check forgery, credit card fraud, and some other various financial crimes. Starburst, by quick summary, was a culmination of a three-year investigation involving the Financial Crimes Task Force targeting an organized criminal enterprise consisting of individuals who conspired to commit bank fraud, mortgage fraud, money laundering, identity theft, and a whole host of other violations, including some insurance fraud and retitling of vehicles that were sold overseas. There were over 8,700 victims whose identities were compromised worldwide in this case, with losses in excess of $50 million. Currently, there's been 33 defendants indicted, 28 of which have been convicted. Two were acquitted in federal court recently, along with two others that were convicted in the same trial, and three are currently fugitives. One aspect involving this, again, was buying of high-end vehicles with fraud proceeds. These vehicles were then retitled by the suspects and then shipped overseas and sold for an additional profit, so they actually profited twice from the same act. Another aspect of it, one of the co-defendants, one of the major players in Operation Starburst, is also being prosecuted by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office for selling over $45,000 worth of bogus auto insurance policies. This case was investigated by our partners at the Department of Commerce Insurance Fraud Division. This case, as well as another one, recently received some publicity called Operation Masquerade, again was initiated by local law enforcement participation. In Operation Masquerade, as many as 12 local defendants were recently indicted for a $2 million fraud scam that involved primarily identity theft, which involved victims in Minnesota and 13 other states. This case was pretty much initiated, and the case agent or lead agent on it was an officer from Chief Eckstead's Police Department in Baxter, who, working with the postal inspectors, pretty much put this case together. The Financial Crimes Task Force is a unique model that works. It's unique in that most states, the federal agencies, host these types of task forces with local participation invited in. In this case, the Financial Crimes Task Force, which is again hosted by BCA, is entering its 12th year and does the opposite, but with the same successful results. This success, however, will diminish without the sustained participation of local law enforcement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee representatives. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to our good partner in the private sector, Mr. Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Thank you, Chief Deputy. And Mr. Johnson, if you state your name and title and begin, sir. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. It's a trade association of insurance companies, including auto insurers, that are the funding source for the auto theft prevention program. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, maybe I'm here as much as anything as I'm a historian on the auto theft prevention program. I worked originally in passing the law way back when on a bipartisan basis, and just maybe make four quick points, Mr. Chairman, that from our industry's perspective, why House File 2706 is a good bill to pass, and I'm delighted to see it's got bipartisan sponsorship. First, the auto theft program and the dollars collected. What this bill does, it's important that the dollars collected from consumers be used for the purposes of why they were collected. And obviously, when all of you and any of your constituents get their auto insurance, they'll see a notation on there that says auto theft prevention surcharge, something to that effect. So it's required that that be printed on the policy declaration pages. And we're not using all those dollars collected, as we're telling consumers, for auto theft prevention purposes. Half of that money, or about half, or the $1.3 million in the statute, is diverted into the general revenue. And so we think that it's important that the dollars be used for the purposes collected. That's not being done today, and House File 2706 takes a modest step towards restoring us back to that. So I think our industry has always opposed the diversion of the money out of it. There are needs in the community, as you've heard some of, just spoken of in terms of the use of these dollars. And I think what we see here today is that the Financial Crimes Task Force, and as I was approached and looked at the proposal and the bill, it's an appropriate and a measured step. The use of the dollars collected for auto theft to allocate some of those dollars to the Financial Crimes Task Force, their work and activities, and some of the obviously the crimes that are investigated, I believe it's appropriate, and some of those have already been described for you here this morning. So we think that the bill, as it's structured, and the money that's in terms of where it's moved, again, it's an important public policy step. It's consistent with the goals for the dollars that were collected. We think this is a change that makes sense. Having said that, we also just, and I'll end with Mr. Chairman, that we work very closely with the Commerce Department. We've met with Commerce Commissioner Mike Rothman, meet with him regularly. There's an advisory board to Commissioner Rothman on the expenditures of grants under the program. And in our commitment to Commissioner Rothman and to you all is that we would like to see all the dollars collected used for the purposes collected. We're not doing that today. And so we're committed to that goal. House File 2706, again, I think is a step in the right direction. We support the bill and would urge you all to pass the bill today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Priest, do you have additional testimony?
Not for the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff, I had a question about the funding. I understand that the Office of Justice Programs over at Department of Justice have provided you a grant last year for this, for these efforts. Do you know what the status of the grant is for this year?
At this point, it's my understanding, again, not working for Department of Public Safety, it's my understanding, though, that the grant money may not be available, and my concern is that every year at this time, should we rely on money that we may or may not get, and we're really looking for a dedicated source from year to year. But right now, it's my understanding that grant money is not going to be awarded.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. Yep. And Sheriff, is there have you thought through any other ways that we might be able to fund this rather than directly through the general fund?
Well, we did. We at one of the advisory board meetings, we actually set up a subcommittee, which I was part of, and the gentleman behind me, to come up with some other ideas. We thought of everything from putting a fee on credit card transactions, ATM transactions, perhaps a fee on money wires, since so many of these crimes are involved with wiring money overseas to the companies that you know provide those services, putting some type of fee with them. I came up with an idea of, but nobody seemed to like, of possibly putting a fee, a small fee on each driver's license when people purchase it, because just about every type of identity theft or fraud we work involves some form of counterfeit or you know, fictitiously obtained driver's licenses. So we looked at a lot of different areas. This one, we saw the money was available, came to our attention that the money had already been allocated for law enforcement purposes, and we sought this as a good opportunity to perhaps bring back some of that money from the general fund for its intended purpose of combating auto theft, insurance fraud, and then, of course, financial crimes, which so closely are related nowadays.
And just one final follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're working these cases, how do you coordinate that with the Department of Public Safety, and how does all those coordination efforts work? Is that through MNJAC, or how does that?
Well, some of the information we do does go through MNJAC, but the typical case, and it's been this way for years, really, with any task forces, either the Secret Service or FBI or any other federal agencies started, the cases are coordinated. They start at the local level. The local departments, through education and the outreach from the task force, are aware of the task force's presence. They'll contact the task force, which, again, is run under BCA, and say, hey, we've got this case. It's too big for us to handle. It's spanning multiple jurisdictions. We can't do it with our limited resources. Can you help us with your statewide and national reach to the feds to work this investigation? So the coordination is already there because the task force is actually housed under BCA, under the control of BCA. So we're already doing the coordination with DPS, and in that, that's their investigative arm of the department.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you,
Sheriff. Any other testimony? We have Mr. Peter, and you'll have to pronounce your last name. I'll butcher it. If you could have a seat there and give your name and title and
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce. Mr. Chair and members, Department of Commerce, unfortunately, is not supportive of this bill at this time. And a little bit of backstory, and I would echo much of the testimony that has been before you already today, and I share Mr. Johnson's characterization of our relationship and how we've worked together, both on the auto theft prevention fund and also with the Financial Crimes Task Force as well. However, the language as is written now creates a sizable hole in the general fund, $650,000, which in this non-budgetary year, at the moment, we don't have an opportunity to fill. And that creates a problem for the department. And while we share, and I would echo Mr. Johnson's characterization of these are dollars that are paid by Minnesota consumers. The fund is funded by a 50-cent charge on every 6 months of auto insurance sold in the state. And we share the concern that you know, money is money that is taken to the general fund off the top of this account each biennium is not going towards the purpose that it is originally dedicated for. This is a dedicated fund. And this is an issue which came up last session, this and several other dedicated accounts that are housed at the Commerce Department were looked at as possible ways to fill general fund holes in the budget. And the legislature decided not to go that route because I think everyone is in agreement that that dollars that are supposed to be dedicated for a specific purpose should be used for that purpose. The commissioner at the time, at the end of last session, talking to both legislators and stakeholders, stated his commitment, and I would reiterate it here, to try to capture that $1.3 million to use it for auto theft related grants to law enforcement and prosecutorial agencies as we do now around the state. And that is something that we're committed to working through in the budget process, but at the moment we have that concern. A little bit of just about the successes of the auto theft program, and I do think that this speaks to the need in this one particular area. And again, this is not necessarily a commentary on the Financial Crimes Task Force or the other items that are listed in the bill that that dollars could be used to prosecute or go after. And there are many things that we work on right now with our insurance fraud unit and in partnership with both the Financial Crimes Task Force and the law enforcement agencies represented here today. The Department of Commerce announced late last week and in fact is having a press conference today with law enforcement agencies from around the state, a second round of grants for this biennium out of the auto theft account. Total grants for this biennium are now $3.786 million, which is the largest amount that's ever been granted out of the auto theft account in a biennium, and we are expecting to have a third round yet this year. Those dollars went to 21 recipients around the state, and I think that speaks to the need on the auto theft side. So again, Mr. Chairman, we have concerns about the hole that this puts in the general fund. We do think these dollars are being put to good use in this particular area, and again, supportive of the work of the Financial Crimes Task Force, and I think we would be very supportive in helping Commissioner of Public Safety try to increase the appropriation for the work that they do, but we do not think that this is the proper way to fund that program. So I'd stand for questions. Thank you.
Did you either one of you have any response to that, Chief Deputy, or just let it ride?
Well, again, I'm a little bit biased from the law enforcement side, but I think we've identified an amount of money here that's going to the general fund that we're simply asking to be split with our partners, the Department of Commerce, and with Financial Crimes Task Force to help us continue with a very small handful of five or six local law enforcement that we have now and the handful of federal agents we have now to continue to work and investigate $50 million fraud cases, which we're capable of working given the right amount of resources. With additional funding, we can bring on more local partners who have already expressed an interest in being part of our task force, but simply are restricted because of financial constraints within their departments. And we can certainly encourage more participation as well as the education aspects and the training aspects of the task force with some additional resources. And again, feel this is a pretty good way of doing it, going about it, taking this money that had been previously dedicated to the auto theft grant.
Okay. Any other testimony? Any questions from members? Okay. Representative Creasel, want to renew your motion?
Yep, Mr. Chair, I would like to renew my motion that House File 2706 pass and be sent to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carried. Thank you, Representative Creasel. We'll move on to House File. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. House File 2585, the Statewide Radio Board Authority, expanded and updated. Representative Creasel, we're going to have the testifiers move up to the table, and in the meantime, go ahead and move your bill.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 2585 to pass and be sent to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, Representative Kreisel has moved his bill. Representative Kreisel, go ahead with your testimony, however you proceed to wish.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is an agency bill that was brought to me. It makes various technical and policy changes to statute to encompass new emergency communications technologies. I will have the testifier outline directly what it would do, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead and state your name and title, ma'am, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jackie Mines, and I am the Director of Emergency Communication Networks, a division of the Department of Public Safety. Our division is responsible for providing support in the direction of the two programs that manage two critical public safety communication networks, the 911 network and the statewide shared radio communications network, also known as ARMOR. The statute governs the technical and operational standards for 911 and the ARMOR system to ensure integrity of the emergency communication networks. It outlines the funding that supports the two services, how carriers are to integrate into the 911 network. It outlines the responsibility of the public safety answering points, or PSAPs. It outlines the commissioners and the ECN staff duties, and also identifies the governance structure and powers of the statewide radio board and the regional radio boards. The current 911 network is 30-plus years old. There is a need for the inclusion of terms that relate to new technology in use and clarify current procedure. The state is currently embarking on the initial stages of updating the network to a high-speed voice and data network, and the language needs to be clarified and be consistent with the new technology. The SRB, Statewide Radio Board, is a premier governance structure that includes engagement from all stakeholders and local feedback on operational use from the local users. The SRB has a desire to expand the responsibilities to include all interoperable emergency communications for public safety. Changes are technical in nature by clarifying current practice and updating terminology, and there is no change to how the program is funded, the fee collection process or the amount, or the responsibilities of any of the parties that we outlined above. I can go through each section if that would be helpful, Mr. Chair.
I don't know if we really need that.
Unless somebody really wants to or doesn't understand the present bill. And we want to make grammatical changes. Representative Kreisel, anything to add?
There is one more testifier on the list. We could bring them up, and then if there's any issues, we could go over it then, Mr. Chair.
Sounds good. Why don't we have that one, and then we'll ask for more questions. Mr. Moody, is that it?
Margaret Vessel from the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board is standing in for Martin Moody.
Oh, okay. Go ahead to state your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Margaret Vessel, Beston Flanagan, representing the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board. We're just up here to say that we've been working with the department on the changes and would be supportive of any of passing this bill.
Okay. Any questions yet? If not, we've got a... then we'll go to there's another testifier, but we'll go ahead and ask your question. No, I think that's expressing concern, so if you want to ask some questions now, go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a fiscal impact then to the local counties, communities, as they upgrade their 911 systems? I mean, is there a cost involved that needs to be accounted for?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department has received a federal grant to offset any costs at the local level for upgrades to the next generation 911 network at present.
So no.
No.
Okay, then the next testifier would be Brent Christensen, Minnesota Telecom Alliance. Mr. Christensen, why don't you state your name and title and begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I represent the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, and we're a trade association that represents over 80 independent telephone companies in Minnesota. Basically, our members are the ones that make 911 work. And I just wanted to appear before you today just to tell you that we wholeheartedly support the concept of the bill. We do have some concerns about some of the language. We had a meeting with Ms. Mines on Friday to work out some of those details, and we're going to continue to work with her to move forward. We just don't think the bill in its current form is ready to go, but we are working with her to make sure that it does. With that, I would entertain any questions.
Okay, seeing none. And yes, Mr. Christensen is going to Commerce from here, so we get another chance to testify there. So,
great. Well,
okay. Any questions from committee? Representative Kriesel, did you have any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Just like to renew my motion that House File 2585 pass and be sent to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, Representative Kriesel renewed his motion. You folks have heard it. Any questions? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Kriesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Woodard, are you ready with 2723?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Woodard, go ahead and move your bill, and do you have any amendments?
There are no amendments, Mr. Chair, but I would like to move House File 2723, recommend for passage, and sent to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. Representative Woodard, why don't you begin as you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies for the slight delay. I figured a Creaser bill would be a little bit more controversial than that. So, Mr. Chair and members, House File 2723 would add statutory authority for the sealing of stays of adjudication and plea diversions if the petitioner has not been charged with any new crimes for 1 year following discharge from probation. Currently, in most cases, only court records under the judicial branch are able to be sealed, but this would allow for records to be sealed, including the executive branch. It also removes the expungement, petition, and hearing requirement for stays of adjudication and diversion programs if the prosecutor agrees to the expungement and makes a good faith effort to inform any victims. It also makes access to previously sealed records easier for prosecution and corrections by not requiring a court order. This does require prosecutorial agreement in order for this to happen. It does save money by reducing the number of court hearings and would only involve cases where all charges were ultimately dismissed. So what this does is trying to address an issue where the sealing of records under the current expungement statute, when somebody completes this day of adjudication or diversion program, remains a law-abiding citizen for one additional year, and the prosecutor must agree to that sealing. It allows the sealing of those records, but it does not allow for sealing of records if there were violent offenses or a conviction was the result. Mr. Chair, for those of you who were fans of the previous administration, you'll like this bill because he vetoed this bill. Governor Pawlenty did veto this bill, but it was because he didn't think that the prosecutors were as involved as they should be. And so what the advocates of this particular issue did is went to the county attorneys, worked out language that does require the agreement by the prosecutor before the expungement would occur. And so I think we've resolved the issue that Governor Pawlenty previously had. I'll also note that the authors of this bill are, you probably won't see many other bills with the same authors with myself and Representative Moran and Representative Dabney, Representative Moline. So this is really a bipartisan bill that we're trying to address one particular issue within the judiciary. So, Mr. Chair, on that, I do have a couple of testifiers. I know Mr. Haas would like to testify.
You folks should go ahead and testify, but keep in mind, if you could explain it in layman's terms for us, what it used to be in this procedure and how this changes it in layman's terms. I wasn't too wild about the bill when it started, but now it seems like, now that I understand it and see the authors on it and the explanation, I'm coming up much more comfortable with it. So if you could give the same comfortability to my members, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, which author in particular did bring you comfort?
probably you. Mr. Haas.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just quickly want to thank Representative Woodard and all the other authors on this bill and all of you for taking the time on this important issue. I'm with the Council on Crime and Justice, a Minneapolis-based nonprofit organization. We're members of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, a coalition of over 65 Minnesota organizations. In layman terms, Mr. Chair, here's what we hear from people quite often. I was told that if I plead guilty, I'd get a stay of adjudication. If I did my probation, I wouldn't have a conviction on my record. Their defense attorney told them that, and the prosecution and judge told them that. What they often hear is, I won't have a record. That is not true. They won't have a conviction on their record. They'll still have a record of that stay of adjudication or diversion program that employers, landlords, and others will see under current records retention law and some of the, you know, around some of the other issues. People can see those records for the rest of their lives. And the reason that is, and they can't, under current expungement law, those records cannot be sealed at the executive branch. So they can't be sealed at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, at law enforcement, or Department of Human Services. They can be sealed at just the court, but because of the way the statute has been interpreted by the courts, the statute says only cases resolved in somebody's favor can be sealed at the executive branch. And that would be diversions where somebody hasn't had to admit to the facts on the record. Many counties, when they do a diversion, now they require some admission of facts. Also, for a stay of adjudication, you have to plead guilty, and then you get the stay. So that's why these cases don't currently qualify under the statute. So this would add those to the statute and make it so with successful diversion or probation completion, a year of remaining law-abiding, as you've already heard, and the prosecutor agreeing, they could have those records sealed. This is an issue that we've been working on for about 3 years now. I've been working lockstep with the County Attorneys Association on this. They are very supportive of this issue. There's the change that Representative Woodard just mentioned that would have probably satisfied Governor Pawlenty in 2010. I can tell you that there's the criminal defense attorneys are not crazy about that change, but they're not here opposing it. I'm not crazy about it. I think it maybe gives the prosecutors a little too much power, but it's worth it to give people a remedy. On that note, there was nobody from the association itself, Minnesota Association of County Attorneys, who could testify this morning, but Mr. Bob Johnson, the former Anoka County Attorney, is here to give you just a brief overview of the prosecutor perspective on this. Thank you.
Mr. If you could give us a brief overview and state your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chairman, member, my name is Bob Johnson. I was county attorney in Anoka County for 28 years and served for 11 years before that as an assistant county attorney. So I have bumping up on 40 years of experience as a prosecutor. It was interesting, Mr. Chairman, to listen to the discussion about Financial Crimes Task Force, because I chaired the Financial Crimes Task Force for a number of years. It was kind of revisiting an old issue, and it was an important step forward, the Financial Crimes Task Force, so I hope you can do what you can on that. I'm going to give you some statistics first, because I think they're important to understand not just this issue, but also other criminal justice issues and the growth of government over the years. I think you will find this of some interest. When I started in 1968, Anoka County was a little over 150,000 in terms of population. 2010, it was a little over 300,000 in population, doubled, a little more than doubled. When I started, the criminal code, Chapter 609, was 35 pages. It's over 200 pages long now. When I started, we had less than 100 cases a year, felony cases, in Anoka County. In 2006, we prosecuted over 1,800 cases in 2006. When I started, the staff in the Anoka County Attorney's Office was 3 lawyers and 2 secretaries. When I left, I had 40 lawyers 40. I had a staff of over 100, secretaries, paras, other staff. My budget was in excess of $10 million a year. We've had some growth in government over that period of time, and we've had a significant increase in terms of the number of people that we pulled into the criminal justice system. So I wanted to give you that perspective as you look at not just this bill, but other bills involving criminal justice and government. A prosecutor's responsibility by case law and by all the standards, professional standards that there are out there, is to do justice. So it's not just to convict, it's trying to do justice. What I learned in the 40 years and the tens of thousands of cases that went through my office, most of which I had some voice in resolving, is that every offender is different. Every offense is different. So let's just take a couple real quick ones. The case that started stays of adjudication was an 18-year-old or so having sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend. We used to have those sorts of cases. Often they would end up getting married, they'd have children. That's a crimsex 3. That's a registerable sex offense. This bill wouldn't affect it if it's charged out as a crimsex 3. But I submit that there is a difference between an 18-year-old having sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend and ending up marrying her and having a child that resulted from that sex, and a 45-year-old friend of the mother who's having sex with her 15-year-old daughter. Big difference. Should be treated differently. It's a big difference between dealing with a drug offender who's moving a lot of product, or we're dealing with the girlfriend of the drug offender who's in love with the drug offender, happens to be the person who's told to go make the sale, and she's in love with this guy and she does what she's told, perhaps even dominated. Big difference between her and the drug dealer that we're dealing with. You see that time and time again. It's remarkable, the difference between them. So I've got a charge to do justice. How should I treat them? How do I deal with the difference between the offense and the offender in all the different thousands and thousands of cases we have? Now, what's changed about this is it used to, back when we had less than 100 cases a year, we were dealing primarily, as I say, with more significant offenses. The number of offenses have been increased, the number of people we pulled in have been increased, and we're trying to do the right thing with regard to them. Over the years, as I've done a lot of criminal justice policy work nationally, my focus has been more towards public safety. So I'm trying to increase public safety with the work that I do. I think you may be familiar with the concept of reentry. I did a lot of work for the Council of State Governments in their reentry, sat on their reentry policy council. And what we saw was that most of the people that we deal with, okay, most of the couple thousand people that would go through my office are not truly evil people. Evil people are easy to deal with. We just max them. Not very many of those. Most of them are just people who got caught up in a dumb situation. They're not inherently bad people. So how should we treat those people? We have to punish them, but not destroy them. So if we destroy them, we're starting to tag them. I wrote a column. I led a couple of national criminal justice organizations. I wrote a column called Every Sentence is a Life Sentence. Because once you get into the system, you're there forever. You got a 30-year-old drug offense? I'm sorry, not a chance. Not a chance. So you start creating, with the numbers, you start creating an underclass of people. They can't get a job because as soon as they declare the drug offense, or as soon as they do the criminal history check on them and they see the old drug offense 30 years ago, you know, it goes in the waste paper basket. I was sitting, when I was chair of the Financial Crimes Task Force, with Michael Campion, not exactly a bleeding heart liberal in my experience, and Michael was saying to me, you know, I get this guy I was talking to, came back from Iraq, and he had an old drug offense, and that he'd been working at this job for years, had an old drug offense, and they told him they had to fire him. And Michael said, that's just wrong. And I thought it was wrong, too. You know, with this new age, once you get an offense on your record, you can't get a job, can't get an apartment. You don't need a license to sell drugs. You don't need a license to burglarize houses or steal. So it impacts adversely public safety if you don't give these people a chance to become productive members of society. Now, what this bill is a tool. It's a step forward, giving prosecutors a tool to do justice in the right case, judgment of the prosecutor, do justice in the right case, and improve public safety by giving those people an opportunity to be productive members of society again. I urge you to pass the bill.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from members? Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, what if the person reoffends? Can they then unseal those records?
Mr. Haase, you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, this bill actually makes it easier for prosecutors and corrections officials to access previously sealed records. And that was one of the deals we worked out with prosecutors. Currently, prosecutors and law enforcement, and this is important for you all to know, I think, in, when this issue comes up in other areas. If law enforcement or prosecutors do a background check on somebody, it's going to come back and say a sealed record exists. If they want to access the actual case records and what happened, they have to get an ex parte court order. Ex parte meaning they can do it without other parties present. But they have to go to a judge to get an order. This legislation allows prosecutors and corrections to open the previously sealed record without a court order.
Representative Grunhagen? Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Any other testimony, Representative Warner?
No, I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. This bill is going. Okay, Representative Ward, do you want to restate your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I do that, I just also want to recognize Representative Gaultier and Representative Johnson as well for being co-authors of this bill, and Representative Creasel and Representative Smith. It is a real representation of a bipartisan solution to an issue, and I really do appreciate that. So I do renew my motion that House File 2723 be passed and referred to the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay, members, any questions? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. All right.
Take your time, Mr. Chair. We do give a little leeway to the authors before they get to the
I have a new vice chair and all.
Mr. Chair, go ahead with the
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move House File 2744 be recommended to pass and move to the HHS committee. Is that the full committee or reform?
Report? Reform.
Which one?
HHS
okay.
Reform.
Okay. All right. Representative Cornish moves House File 2744, recommends for passage, and referred to the HHS Reform Committee. That's your bill.
This should be a quick one. What it is, members, is earlier the governor signed into law, which you know is that community notification, that what people called a loophole or whatever, and allowed for notification where there wasn't any before for the person that is getting out of the SOP. This bill comes over to us from the Senate, and it was felt that Senate counsel and Senator Limmer both thought that there was a couple of cross-references missing. For the DFL's comfort here, there is nothing in here that scary or trick or anything extra for community notification. It just reaffirms the cross-references to make for some clarity, and it doesn't require anything more, putting more restrictions on anything. And Mr. Diebel, did you want to just say just a couple things about the cross-references, what it does?
So Mr. Diebel? Comfort.
Mr. Chair and members, the problem arose because the community notification provision primarily is housed in Section 24, or Chapter 244, but there are some provisions in 253B, which is the MSLP statute, and so it was necessary to make sure that they worked together and that practitioners were directed to both statutes so that they understood that community notification for MSOP patients is covered in two places in statute.
Thank you, Mr. Deal.
And Mr. Yeah. Chair, I haven't asked anybody to testify from the SOP, but I think I can comfortably say that there is no opposition there as long as the bill remains in its current form and nothing is added. They consider it a technical change.
Okay. Are there any testifiers for or against the bill? No. Any questions from members? Okay, would you like to renew your motion, Representative Cornish?
I would like to move the House File 2744 be recommended to pass and move to the HHS Reform Committee.
Representative Cornish renews his motion that HF 2744 be passed and sent to the HHS Reform Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion's carried.
Thank you.
And next meeting is on Wednesday, March 14th at 10:15 a.m. in this building, in this room. Meeting is adjourned.